Hello, my name is Sean Poole. I'm with Science Progress, and I'm here on the phone with James Powell, author, scientist, climate activist, to talk about the new book, The Inquisition of Climate Science. James has a PhD in isotope geochemistry from MIT. He has three honorary doctorates of science, has been a college professor, a college president, the president of Reed College, a museum president, and he has an asteroid named after him. Additionally, James Powell was appointed by both President Reagan and President Bush to the National Science Board, which is the body that makes policy for the National Science Foundation. So thank you, James, for being here.
Happy to do it. Thanks for allowing it.
So what was the impetus for deciding to write about climate change?
I used to be a college professor and a practicing scientist, and then I became an administrator. And I suppose as a way of keeping my hand in science and having some intellectual content to my life, I began to write science books. I'm a generalist. I'm not a climate scientist,
right.
But I think that's an advantage.
Okay.
Because I have no record to defend.
Right. And that's important to note that you are a scientist, someone who's been appointed by more than one United States president to serve on the National Science Board, clearly someone who, with a deep understanding of science, but yourself not a climate scientist. This isn't you trying to defend your work or like you say, defend your record. This is an honest inquiry into climate science. Tell me, James, what were you trying to capture in this book that wasn't being captured elsewhere?
I began writing in the spring of 2009, so not quite 2 years ago. And at that time, there certainly wasn't any prominent book about the denier movement. I think it had sort of caught everybody by surprise, the strength of the movement and the depth of the movement and how well-funded it is and how much people would accept it. These were all surprises, I think, to most scientists. Now, since then, there have been two other books, excellent books. One is called The Climate Cover-Up, and the other is Merchants of Doubt, which cover certain aspects of the denier movement. And I've gone over some of the same ground, but I've tried to write a as broad and comprehensive a book as possible so that I not only talk about the apostate scientists like Lindzen and Michaels and Singer, but I also talk about the non-scientist deniers, George Will and Michael Crichton. Bjorn Lomborg and Christopher Monckton, and what makes them tick, and how I show how easy it is to refute their claims, and how again they really offer us nothing except to deny a particular field of science with nothing better to replace it. I talk about some of the most prominent denier arguments as examples. SkepticalScience.com does a great job of refuting in one sentence, I don't know what the current number is, something like 130-plus denier arguments. And I pick out some of the most prominent and the ones most often used and try to show how little is behind them. I talk about their strategies, their rhetorical devices. I talk about the funding of the denier movement, the denier industry, and in particular, I recommend that we listen to the insurance companies, because in the short run, at least, the fossil fuel industry makes more money, has greater profits, the more fossil fuels we burn and the higher the temperature rises, but the insurance industry, their risk goes up with global temperatures and sea level and so forth. So I think there is an industry to trust, and it's the international reinsurance industry, the big companies like Swiss Re and Munich Re, Allianz and others. If you read what they say, they not only do not deny climate science, but they say that it's a great threat to their industry and therefore all the companies that they're insuring.
How do you think we can get them to be more vocal, or why do you think they haven't been more vocal about this issue? I mean, clearly the fossil fuel industry, and you show in the book, you know, has done quite a lot to be vocal about you know, denying the science of climate and to fund other groups who will do it on their behalf. But why haven't we been able to mobilize that more and have that be a stronger voice?
That is a very good question. That's worth a good deal of thought. Of course, the fossil fuel industry, led by ExxonMobil, funds a whole variety of front groups, which appear to be legitimate think tanks or research groups or whatever they might appear to be, but in fact they're simply being funded by the fossil fuel industry, by big oil and big coal, to foster denial of climate science. And the insurance industry, as far as I know, is not funding Climate Progress or SkepticalScience.com or...
That's right.
Maybe we haven't asked them. But they're the largest, one of the very largest industries in the world, having even greater profits than big oil and big coal. So, and they have a huge stake in not letting runaway global warming happen. So you make a very good point, and maybe some people should give some thought to how they could secure funding from the insurance industry. Maybe the IPCC could get some funding there that would help support their efforts.
And indeed, the book really, I think, does a great job of kind of mapping out the landscape of the denier industry. I think I might call it, and you might agree that that would be an accurate term to use.
Yes.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions that are being pushed by this sort of anti-science denial industry?
Right. Well, the way I think about it is that the biggest lie is that we should reject climate science, even though the deniers have no alternative explanation of the facts that we observe. They have no way of explaining why global temperatures are rising and why 2010 looks like it's going to be the hottest year on record, why there are twice as many high temperature records being set annually as low temperature records, why glaciers and sea ice are melting, why sea level is rising, why species are migrating. They have no explanation for this, but they ask us not to accept the explanation that science provides. And that's not the way science works. The way it works is that scientists make observations, they develop a theory, they test the theory, and then often a better theory comes along and displaces the older theory, which didn't do quite as good a job and couldn't explain certain facts. And in that way, Einstein replaced Newton. And in my field of geology, the idea of drifting continents replaced the idea that continents are fixed in space. But the deniers don't have a better theory. They don't have any theory. They simply have no explanation for what we observe around us. And neither do you see the deniers writing an article and submitting it to a professional journal, with a few exceptions, that shows there's something wrong with climate science. If it is wrong, why can't they demonstrate that it's wrong? So to me, this is a kind of almost unprecedented anti-science audacity to ask us to reject a whole field of science for no good reason.
You mentioned the IPCC a moment ago, and the IPCC has come under a lot of criticism in the media. So what do you see as the way forward for the IPCC? How do they fix their image? Do they even need to? Do they need to reform the way they're doing things? Or have they just been, you know, cast in an ill light by those in the media who would seek to undermine climate science?
I think the IPCC has undertaken one of the most complex jobs in history, and that they've done very well at it. If you simply look at the volume of material that they have produced, it's obvious that there are going to be a few mistakes. And whenever there is a mistake, then the denier community jumps all over it, or even they even make up a mistake, such as the Amazon Gate, which turns out not to be a mistake after all. And the media love controversy, and they extend these accusations around the world, before you know it. There's a saying, something like, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on, something like that. And to me, that's what's going on. So I give the IPCC a lot of credit for doing about the best job that could be done in a very, very difficult situation. I think, like, as I was saying a minute ago, we scientists have been caught by surprise, caught unawares by the depth of the denier movement and how well funded it is and how many people were willing to go along with it. And I think the IPCC was, to some extent, caught unawares as well as to just how much importance people were going to attach to their report. I think they need more funding. I think they need to speed up their reporting process. I think the next one is coming out in 2013, and that would be the previous one. The fourth assessment is 2007, and that's just too long, given all that's at stake and how fast the evidence for global warming is mounting. So I think the IPCC needs to speed up the process. Perhaps they need to produce a report annually and have a more of an ongoing process. Of course, I'm not on the IPCC. I don't know how it works in detail, but I do know that 5 years is too long.
Yeah, it seems like an annual or a biannual report would make more sense. Once every 5 years, this is hardly a blip on the media's radar, it seems like. So on the topic of the media, what's going on here? Why is it that the media seems to be unable to give an accurate portrayal of climate science? What's the problem?
There's no doubt that the media has distorted the public's impression and reduced public acceptance of global warming, climate change science. And this isn't just somebody's opinion. It goes back to some scholarly work that the Boykoff brothers did in the early 1990s. One of the things I do in my book is take the 5 months, January, February, March, April, May, 2010, in other words, the first 5 months of this year, and I looked at the headlines of articles in the New York Times written by Times reporters. I think there were 10 of them, and maybe there were 12. I forget exactly. But I showed that all but two of those, if you simply read the headline, you would get the impression that the case for global warming was weakening. And then if you went ahead and took the other two and started actually reading the article, you also could well wind up with the belief that the science was weakening. And of course, during that five-month period, that was the warmest 5 months in history. And there was lots of other evidence from sea ice and so forth. So here is the so-called paper of record, the New York Times, its own reporters, in their headlines, creating a false impression about a very important matter of science. I have a lot of trouble explaining that. I don't believe it's just an accident. I believe that perhaps it's teach the controversy, as you and Joe put it on your website. That is, controversy sells and certainty does not, even near certainty does not. And so somehow the mainstream, the prestige press, is in this mindset of presenting a controversy where really none exists. There really are very few fields of science where there is as much general agreement as there is that global warming is real, it's happening, that we caused it, and it's dangerous. There are very few scientific beliefs that are more accepted and have more evidence behind them than that, and there's certainly none in which we have a greater stake. So this is really important, and I know we're all hoping that it's not going to take some Pearl Harbor or series of Pearl Harbor, some major catastrophes that really one cannot deny stem from global warming before the press starts getting it right and before people start doing something about it.
there is still some uncertainty in climate science, is there not? I mean, for example, in science, there's always uncertainty. That's what science is about. It's about exploring uncertainty. Different researchers are going to have slightly different opinions. There's always going to be that little bit of uncertainty. How do we go about questioning the science in a useful way without feeding this kind of anti-science frenzy?
It's in the mores of science for scientists to be cautious or reticent, as Jim Hansen put it. We have not tended to overstate our case. We understate it. We allow for the possibility that we might be wrong. And if you go to scientific meetings, that's what you observe. But there are still certain things that we know. We know that the Earth is warming. We know that humans are the cause. And we know that if it continues, it threatens the future of humanity. We're in a different arena now. We're in an arena in which, in my opinion, science is under the greatest attack in history. And one of the things that has shocked me as I did the research for this book is just how broad-based this attack on science is. It's not just global warming. It was, for 40 years, the denial that primary smoking, tobacco smoke, caused cancer, and then later that secondhand smoke caused cancer. We have creationism. There's a group who deny that the AIDS virus causes, that the HIV virus causes AIDS. And I have a little section about that in the book, and if you read about that movement, they almost exactly parallel the global warming denier movement. We have had industries that denied that asbestos was harmful, or chromium was harmful, or beryllium, and on and on and on. People are, industry and many people are prepared to simply reject some part of science that their ideology or their religion leads them to disagree with while enjoying the benefits of all the other parts of science. And I would just say that I think it's time for scientists to stand up and be counted, not be reticent, not be cautious, not say, for instance, that there's no way to know whether Katrina was produced by global warming, but say very forcefully that a Katrina is exactly the sort of thing we expect more of under global warming, and to repeat that at every opportunity. I think we need to look for opportunities to speak out and to write, and we have to have the scientific debates within the forum of science, at professional meetings, in peer-reviewed journals, and so forth. But when we're speaking to the public, I think it's time to be have the courage of our convictions and speak as forcefully as we legitimately can.
You close the book with by saying it comes down to trust, and I think that's an apt way of putting it. But how do we earn that trust? How do scientists go about regaining that trust and expanding it? And
well, I think they have to do impeccable science and continue to do that. You trust people who have been trustworthy, who have demonstrated trustworthiness. And I would ask anybody to show us where a whole field of science has demonstrated that they're not trustworthy. There really are only three possibilities, Sean, about global warming. One is that scientists are right. Another is that they're wrong, that they've just made an honest mistake. This requires the whole world community of climate scientists to have made an honest mistake. It boggles the mind. The third possibility is that scientists are wrong, and they are deliberately wrong, that they are deceiving the public, conducting the greatest hoax in world history. And as I have a whole chapter about that, then that's absurd. What I say is that anybody who thinks you could organize a world conspiracy of scientists has never attended a single faculty meeting. If there were a hoax, I have no doubt that it would have come out in those stolen emails. from the University of East Anglia. There were over 1,000 emails, I think over a million words, and there was not a single bit of legitimate evidence of any kind of hoax or conspiracy. So there are only three possibilities. Global warming is right, it's wrong, and scientists have made an honest mistake, or it's wrong and scientists are perpetrating a hoax. Well, the second two simply don't compute. So you're left with only the possibility that we have to trust scientists because they've proven themselves trustworthy, and we have to believe what they're telling us about the risk of global warming.
So I guess the message is, let science correct science, and don't let faith, religion, philosophy, politics engage in what is ultimately a scientific discussion. So we're running out of time here, but is there anything else that you would like to add before we wrap up?
One of the things that I wanted to mention, Sean, is that a few days ago, I think last week sometime, you had a post that reported on a article or series of articles from the Royal Society that was asking the question, when will the Earth experience 4 degrees centigrade, 7 degrees Fahrenheit warming? And they looked at this from different ways, but they concluded that if we stay on this present trajectory, which so far we've not been able to get off of, there will be 4 degrees centigrade warming in the 2070s. But if the feedbacks are worse than we have allowed, there could be 4 degrees centigrade warming in the 2060s. And this hit home with me because I have a 24-year-old daughter, Joanna. I am 74, so when Joanna is my age, she may well be living in a world that is 4 degrees centigrade warmer, 7 degrees Fahrenheit, and I believe that that will be a very different world and a very deleterious world, and that she will rightfully blame this generation if we allow that to happen.
Well, that's what we're working for here every day. And I think your book is a great resource towards this end. So thanks again for calling in and agreeing to speak with us today. It's been a real pleasure having you.
Well, thank you so much, Sean. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Again, I'm Sean Poole. This is Science Progress, and that was James Powell, the author of The Inquisition of Climate Science, a new book which is being released by Columbia University Press and is available for pre-order on Amazon today.